I have a little disclaimer that I want to read because of I just want you to understand what's going on here. It's an important point to be made that the ideas, even political partisanship bias that sometimes flares its ugly head, notions or concepts expressed here do not reflect those of this station. And this, when I say station, that means the board of the directors, the membership, and the broadcasters. The ideas are treated sort of like a compilation of research and discussion, including quotes from authors and scholars, and express solely the opinions, interpretations, and thoughts of the host and my guest participants. Kevin and Kirk, welcome to Core of the Matter.
Thank you.
Hello, and thank you.
Hey, we won't talk about what Kirk used to do. Maybe we will at some point. We'll get into that. But anyway, these two guys are from QP Local 1908. Tell me, what is the area that QP 1908 is in? Like, what the workers are where?
QP 1908 comprises of the municipal workers in the local area. We look after Sycamose, Enderby, Salmon Arm, Columbia Shuswap Regional District, and we've got in our local just a little over 200 members.
Okay, 200 members, and mainly in the municipal offices.
That's correct. It's basically municipal operations.
Okay, and that would include maintenance, all those things.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So 200 members. Okay, just a little bit about each one of you. Just a bit. Let's start with you, Kevin. Tell me, how long have you been in Salmon Arm?
I've been in Salmon Arm since 1989. I've been with the city of Salmon Arm for just a little over 25 years, and we've raised our kids here, and we have grandchildren now in town as well.
That surprises me. Grandchildren. I've got a few of those little ankle biters myself. And Kirk, a little bit about you.
I have been in Salmon Arm. I moved from the coast in 2007. And just for something different, somewhere better to raise my family.
How many kids do you have?
I have four.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's
we came here with two, and now there's two more.
Must be the air. Must be the water.
It must be. Yeah. And and speaking of the union, you know, aspect of thing. I mean, yes, you sort of alluded to what I used to do. I did work in radio for many years, but I have also been a union member now for 22 years.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't call it a union. They called it an association. It was a union, the Canadian Air Traffic Control Association. Started in about 1959, and then they went to I forget what year it was. It would have been about 2000, close to 2000. They went with the CAW. They became a local of the CAW. Anyway, well, we know a little bit about you. So now you had some Labor Day's coming up, and on the phone off the air, we talked a little bit about what we would do today. So I want to throw – you're going to do most of the talking. I want you to tell me a little bit about Labor Day, because I think that was the first thing, a little bit about the history and important milestones maybe that you want to talk about.
Yeah, it's labor history and
– Labor history.
In the BC area, there's not a lot that people know because it's obviously not a curriculum in the school system at all.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. Something about maybe some censorship, I'm not sure. Anyway, Labor Day basically for us is a time to reflect the struggles and the accomplishments of the progresses made by working people here in BC and all over the world. There's far too many people that think Labor Day is really just a long weekend at the end of summer, and it's not. I think we in the labor movement, those of us who are members of the union, need to do a better job of connecting the dots for people, regular working people around Labor Day, and especially our young people. We certainly don't learn much about the history, as I said before, in the schools, which I think is really a huge shame. So many of the rights and the benefits of the people we have at work, union and non-union, would never have happened without hard-fought battles by labor.
I've got a list in front of me here that I showed you, and you take a look through it, and everything that we enjoy, including unemployment insurance, family allowances, we did it. The 40-hour week, I think, predated this, but still, all those things came from disputes and hard work and heavy lifting and sacrifices of the labor movement.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we talk about the eight-hour day. We talk about things like the weekend. Some of us in the workforce, our weekends actually are like Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, Thursday. So, I mean, there's been changes around that as well. But one of the biggest plights we had many, many, many years ago was child labor.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's huge.
And this province tried to change that, I believe. And that, were they successful?
Yeah, to a point. I maybe need to be corrected here, but I think the working age now is 14.
Yeah, it went down, I think, yeah. Yeah. So, I agree, history. It seems that, again, that famous phrase, those that don't know it are doomed to repeat it. But we talk a lot about business these days, a lot about business, but we very seldom hear anything about labor. If we hear about labor, it's a negative thing. It's a strike or a lockout or something. But what did labor accomplish? All those things that they are, all those unsung heroes that are out there doing the heavy lifting every day. Well, go through a little bit of history. Like, where do you want to start?
Sure. Well, let's just talk about our own, you know, government here. You know, right now, our own government still seems to be bent on erasing a certain amount of history. One of the things that happened was that there was a legendary figure by the name of Ginger Goodwin. He was killed in 1918.
I remember the story.
After he led a strike that won the eight-hour day for miners. His death led to the Vancouver General Strike in 1918, the first general strike in Canadian history that turned, also in that turn, led to the Winnipeg Strike of 1919, in which 30,000 union and non-union people walked off for over 6 weeks. So in recognition of Goodwin's contributions to the workers' rights, the NDP government in the 1990s named a stretch of island highway and called it Ginger Goodwin Way, a small but symbolic step towards honoring the contribution of labor activists. And one of the first things the BC Liberals did after forming government in 2001 when Christy Clark was deputy premier was to change that name of the stretch of the Island Highway back from Ginger Goodwin Way. And the worst part of it, they actually took the signs down on Labor Day.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, it's as though some people, I guess, and somebody in the government believes that we can do things without labor. And you just, you know, that's the problem. That's the ingredient that's often forgotten, and it's the most important one.
Well, you know, I don't think a lot of people realize the social issues that labor backs on a continual basis, and including on an international front. You know, CUPE itself, we have several things going in several very poor countries trying to help them out as well.
Through the ILO, the International Labor Organization?
Yes.
That, yeah?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've been quite involved in Cuba and a few other spots, and you know, it's starting to, you know, we're showing up in South America as well as CUPE, helping out with the workers and their work and their plights down there, and women's rights especially.
Yes. When did women get the right? There was in this, I'd have to somehow find it, but it was alluded to when it wasn't the Supreme Court, but the government finally brought in legislation, equal pay for equal work.
Yeah, I do believe that was in the 50s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Anyway, carry on. Let's talk about some of the other things that I've heard of Ginger Goodwin, how he was tracked down by some Mountie and actually shot in the back.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's... Vancouver's history in labor is quite interesting as well. On June 18th, 1935, it's called the Ballantine Pier Strike, which is basically our longshoremen today.
Yeah.
There was well over 1,000 protesters that hit the streets and with supporters, including a contingent of World War I veterans, and they marched down Heatley Street in Vancouver all the way down to the Ballantine Pier. They were met by Vancouver police and then provincial police as well, and they were hiding in boxcars. The protesters were clubbed as they ran away. Some of the protesters were actually shot in the back of the legs with the police shotguns. In total, there were 60 people injured, and 20 of those required hospitalization, and they actually arrested 24 people.
It is good to heal from these, but it's also good to remember. You can forgive, but you still must remember. Yeah, and that's why I think it's, on Labor Day, we should be thinking about these things or coming up at more than 1 week a year. We should always be, because we haven't even touched on one that's close to your heart, and that is the danger, the health and safety issues in this province and in Canada. Workers dying on the job.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to, excuse me for interrupting, Kevin, but it was Kirk that pointed out to me here, the ILO, the International Labor Organization, passes in 1951 at their Convention 100, providing for, and I quote, equal pay for equal work, end quote. Between 1951 and 1959, the federal government and a number of provinces passes similar legislation.
There you go. I guess I was sort of on the mark for the years.
Yeah, you were right on.
You said the 50s.
Yeah.
That's not bad for an old guy.
Yeah.
Grandpa.
Yeah. Kevin, you were talking about a little bit of the history. We talked about Vancouver and the Ballantyne Pier strike, and those workers were injured. There's been a few other incidents. Tell me a little bit.
Yeah, at QP, at one time we were actually called NUPE, N-U-P-E, and it was the National Union of Public Employees, and it became QP in the 60s. And excuse me, Grace Hartman, she's a lady from out in Ontario, a wonderful lady who actually became president of QP at a point of time in her working career. In 1954, she started to work for North York Civic Offices, and that's when she began her career in trade unionism. And Grace, unbelievably, at 62 years of age, was given a 45-day prison sentence for contempt of court, and that was to because her and several other people in QP refused to comply with an order to end a strike, and a lot of this had to do with women's rights and working conditions and working hours, and we're talking a woman who did this in about 1981, I do believe.
Wow.
And
wow.
And this lady went to actual jail for 45 days.
Yeah. For contempt of court. Boy, one wonders, well, people made some pretty big sacrifices to get where we are.
Yeah.
I wanted to, I don't know, have you got something else you wanted to go to, or can we just quickly jump to unemployment insurance? When did it come into being? Because on here it says 1941. So that's fine. It came into being. It was legislated. But right now, I don't know if you have the figures, but what percentage of the workforce, what percentage of those people who are unemployed actually qualify for unemployment insurance payments?
Quite honestly, I have no idea.
It's apparently quite low. I don't know if Kirk has.
No, I don't have that. Sorry.
But all I'm going by, and I don't have the statistics, all I know is that from what I've heard, it's very low. There's so many restrictions. I mean, you got the seasonal workers problem. That's, fishers and some other seasonal work. But there's a lot of restrictions where now there's time restrictions. You have to have so many, the number of weeks. They loosened one and then tightened up another one. I forget which one was which, because I haven't been on unemployment insurance in my life. But still, I've followed it, and it's a needed way for people to get from one job to another. Or when you're out of work, mm-hmm. sometimes it's pretty tough, especially for families.
Well, and I think the other end of it too is to know that the EI fund has been sacrificed by the Conservatives. And I hate to point fingers, but that's really, really where it's happened. And, we have several businesses in town who their businesses were to help support people and get them back to work through helping them with everything from training to lifestyle changes to a whole pile of things. At this point in time, there's been a number of them that have closed their doors because there's no money for them to operate.
Yeah, they just... I don't know what to say. I do have a lot of questions about some of the government decisions concerning workers. Let's just go on to another one that I just wanted to ask about, which is local, more local, because when I wanted to talk to somebody about labor, because it was Labor Day that keyed me to this, so I go looking for the local labor council. And I ended up phoning Vancouver, and they said, no, there isn't one right now. It used to be called the Shuswap Columbia Labor Council.
District Labor Council.
Yeah, District Labor Council. So there isn't one right now.
No, there's not. Unfortunately, there is a huge number of unionized locals, be it everything from teachers to the government workers, the BCGU, and all the private and craft unions as well. And unfortunately, the Labor Council was just not getting the support. I was vice president for the West on it, and it basically got down to there was more executive at meetings than there was members. And it's really unfortunate because that particular organization really is the political wing, shall we say, and also... We do a lot of social things too, such as things like the protein for people, the salmon that we
get to the... Oh, I saw that on the website, protein for people.
Yes.
Yeah, making sure that... Again, for those people, because I hear it all the time, believe me, when I try and sing the praises of the union movement, everybody says, well, they had their time way back when, and we don't need them anymore, and all they're doing is trying to get something for themselves, and I try. And I must admit, I'm not as informed as I should be, about some of the things, and that it was a pleasant surprise to see protein for people associated right with that website when I was looking for counsel. So what's your opinion, just for what it's worth, why is there no, well, you said nobody was coming, why aren't people participating? Are we too well off?
I think people are just strung too thin right now.
Ah.
That's just my opinion. If I could even give an example without naming names and stuff, just even the fall fair that took place this last week, or not the fall fair, sorry, the demolition derby last weekend.
Yeah.
Very successful, a lot of fun, kids enjoyed it, you know, everyone had a great time, but a lot of the volunteering that I used to see just in the previous 5 years that I've been, you know, involved in helping out and stuff, it's dwindling. Yeah. And I asked a buddy that I saw, I said, well, what's up? And he's like, well, I have to work 5 days a week, and then I've got the kids, and I've got this, and then my wife's working the odd, you know, the opposite shifts of me, everybody just to keep their heads up and, you know, above the waterline, and it's just everybody's spread so thin. So I think that translates to a lot of the same things with the Columbia Shuswap Labor Council, if I said it right, sorry. People, in their spare time, they have no time.
Well, that's an interesting comment, Kirk, because I've heard it before, and I try to use it myself to defend people when often friends would say that Canadians are just complacent, and they're not doing this, and they're not doing that, and often it's because they're strung out. They're busier than can be, and people are working longer hours trying to keep their head above water.
Yeah, that's true, too, and I think a certain amount of apathy comes into this as well, and, you know, I've heard people say, well, it's not affecting me today. And there's lots of things that we deal with that affect us each and every day. And that's why it's important to be involved. And, you know, even our very own local union meetings that we have monthly, you know, we most certainly could have more members out. And the only way that our members stay with inclusion in the union and also being informed of what we're doing is to come to the meetings, because we're spread thin. We can't meet with each member and have private discussions. We have to have a monthly meeting to talk about things. And quite honestly, in CUPE, it's the membership that drives a local. And, you know, I'm happy to say that, you know, our local has been fairly blessed compared to some in regards to being able to get members out.
That's
yeah,
good.
No, we have. Yeah,
I remember meetings in our association, and it was pretty hard to get people to come out. You know, and you talk to the, you know, even the shop stewards, some of them weren't always attending. But, of course, come contract time and a few weeks or months leading up to the contract, then you're going to have more interest, and, of course, everybody shows up. But in the meantime, you know, all that work that has to get done, all the paperwork and the discussions, because you have to discuss these issues and try and come. What do you say to people that, you know, that say, well, you know, all I hear about the unions is they're just always trying to get more and more, and what about those other guys that aren't earning very much? What's your answer to that?
Well, you know, we are trying to get more, but you know what? We're trying to get more for everybody. When we work as a labor council, we're out there, you know, under the umbrella of kind of like the BC Federation of Labor, and it's not just unions. We're out there for the individuals who aren't covered. You know, getting to the health and safety end of it, everybody's probably familiar with Grant's Law, and we were fortunate enough 2 years ago to have Grant DePetty's mom and dad speak at our day of mourning on April 28th at Marine Park. And BC Federation of Labor was a huge part of the working alone stuff that happened that unfortunately had a lot to do with the death of Grant. And, you know, even just simple little things here that we see with robberies and things like that. And unfortunately, that law has been watered down, and well, I don't think it has the teeth that it used to.
My opinion is, and it's sad to say this, but I was directly involved because of I was a director at the co-op, and the co-op, it's the interpretation of some people, some of these small businesses, of the law. So what you were getting were these cases where people would come in, they'd have to go inside, give the credit card, or stand in line to give them their credit card, pay a certain amount, then go out, pump the gas, and then come back and get their change. Like, it was so, and this was the original interpretation, it was so time-consuming, we lost a lot of business, a lot of business. In fact, that's why we finally went to, you know, the automatic systems. But you mentioned something really important, I think, that's often forgotten in this debate, and that is the idea of having two people. And it's strange, it's very ironic that as an air traffic controller, when I, in my career, we fought the same battles. They were trying to save money. They don't have one guy. Do you hear about the controller in New York? Went to sleep. Because if you're on a midnight shift, and if you've ever worked shift work, have you worked shift work?
Oh, yeah.
Midnight? You work a few midnight shifts, usually about the third one in my case. And I'm telling you, there was two of us. One, I'd go to sleep. I'd tell the guy, I'm gone for about an hour. I just couldn't stay awake. It was impossible. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to make excuses for people. I'm just saying that the solution was to have two people in a garage. That's part of it. Sorry, you know, part of it. And they never did do that.
Yeah, and both Kirk and I end up working night shifts with the city as well. We're the noisy guys out there with the snow plows and, you know, waking everybody up kind of thing. But
you shouldn't have said that.
Him so more than me.
You guys, here they are, folks. You heard it right here on CKVS. It's Kirk Hansen. It's Kirk. Yeah, I should call. Yeah, Kirk Graham.
That's right. Switch
and
the names.
Kevin Hansen. Yeah, they're the guys making all the noise at 5 o'clock in the morning. But they're plowing your snow. Hey, yeah. You got to get.
You know the one thing, Steve. You know you're asking there. The union's always being out for themselves, and you know we want more and stuff. And I think Kevin, you know, he did tap into it, but. The way to say it in a nutshell is even the private jobs that are held right now, the benefits and everything that's in place for them would not be in place if it weren't for the unions that fought for them.
Exactly.
We basically set everything up for everybody.
And when you take, you're right, and when you take a look at this list of all the things that were gained over the years, you realize they didn't just happen. They happened because the union movement was well enough organized that they could put pressure on government to get these things passed.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
And they finally did. You know, which there's a lot of subjects that I wanted to just talk about, you know, union participation in the union. And a lot of it has to do, I think, with education, but some of it has to do with the media itself and how the media, in a very subtle way or ways, they present the union movement, right?
Well, yes, but I mean, that goes to your disclaimer at the very top of the show.
Yeah.
And the fact that this is non-commercial radio, so you have your skew on things.
Yeah.
But I know from my experience working in media for a long time, as you well know, whether it's, it doesn't matter the medium, radio, TV, newsprint, whatever, they're actually controlled by political parties at some level.
Yeah.
And so if they're not labor-friendly, it doesn't, you're never going to hear anything labor-friendly come through those mediums.
Exactly. And we talked about this a few minutes ago. What do people hear about labor on the radio, or on the radio or television, whatever? It's always about the strikes or whatever. You never hear this stuff about what labor...
No, you'll never hear the positive.
No. Well, and go ahead.
And that's true because, you know, QP here, whether it's 1908 or your school district workers, what people don't hear is when we give things to the Salvation Army for Christmas, when we do the food bank stuff for Christmas, when we're out there fighting. I've had people come to me who are non-union and say, hey, I need some help with a health and safety issue, and we give them the direction and never turn our backs on them. And, you know, we try to help them out that way. And, you know, that stuff isn't what gets out there. The black presses of the world are very political. And, you know, Tom, I don't need to say any more.
Tom Fletcher, my favorite journalist. Jeez, the guy can get me wound up. My researcher is here with me, sitting behind me, Alan Saglofsky. And he did all this work. He went out and got it all. And it's a lovely, quite a complete list of important milestones in Canadian collective bargaining history. And one of them, thank you, Alan. Thank you for that.
Good job, Alan.
Yeah. I want to get to 1997. The Supreme Court makes one of the first decisions to deal with the duty to accommodate the needs of people with disabilities. The Supreme Court of Canada, 1997. Graham, any comments? Kirk, I'm sorry. Kirk.
Well, like I was saying off air, it was something in 97. Didn't, I mean, I thought it was nice.
Yeah.
You know, I was still where I was part of HEU at that time. And, but, you know, it hits home now because, yeah, in 2008, my wife and I, we had a child that was born with it's Down syndrome, trisomy 21, whatever you like to call it. It's the best thing in the world, really, I think.
Yes.
And it's, but, you know, as the father of a child with a disability, you know, moving forward, and something like this is such a huge milestone because I know that there is a future that's going to be a lot different than what it was, you know, for myself, even growing up on the coast. I know in 85, you know, a lot of children with disabilities were just sort of, shoop, you're over there. And this made a huge difference in the lives of people.
You know? Yes.
And this is something brought about by
and
the labor.
I can also say that I have, my daughter has a little girl who has trisomy 21, and you learn, so when this happens, then you learn a little bit more about it. And I think those children have a lot to teach us about life, what's important in life,
mm-hmm.
what's really important. The hugs and the love that little girl can give
it makes you think of the things that we actually worry about in life, and you realize they're not that important.
What's important? She knows what's important.
Yeah, that's right.
Little devil, and she's a feisty little thing too, and it's kind of nice. So I'm glad you mentioned that, Kevin, to me. Or sorry, I keep wanting Kevin's over
two
there.
Two K's in here. Yeah, I know it's
Kirk,
confusing.
Kirk and Kevin.
There's the good looking one and the other
guy.
The older one. The older one.
The older and wiser one. Anyway, getting back, we that was another one of those milestones, and there's three pages of them here of these different milestones, and if I get time, maybe we'll see. I always run out of time. I don't know what it is. It's an interesting subject. Very interesting subject.
There's so much more to that too, Steve. I mean, with that ruling, you know, in this day and age with mental illness, I do believe the figures are 1 in 6 suffer from depression. You know, it's huge. That means that, you know, in the room that you've got in here, I do believe there's 6 of us. One of us probably has depression or a mental illness of some sort, or could.
Yeah.
You know, these people, when they had these issues, were merely just terminated.
Yeah.
Duty to accommodate has made sure that these people are looked after. And you know, that was done to workers who were just different. And that Supreme Court ruling has set in motion many, many things. Bullying, harassment, all those things. Labor was at the forefront to have that stuff represented.
Fight those battles.
You got it. And, you know, it's some of those things, believe it or not, still do occur very often on work sites. And, you know, this gets back to the old question of, unions have outlived their
usefulness.
And, well, you know, when you're being bullied and harassed at work, and WorkSafe has rules and regulations around that now as well, and... you know, the stuff that's out there for your protection under labor law, that was gotten through with a whole lot of pressure from the organized labor out there.
Yep. It is sad that we how quickly we forget, and we love to badmouth the union movement, and then we find out, whoops, it was those guys that, you know, one of the answers that I give anyway when people badmouth the union movement, my answer is, look, it's the only organized group of people, really organized, with any clout, with any power, to counterbalance, that would be a nice word, the other. And what you're seeing right now, I don't care anybody who watches what's going in Canada, going on in Canada at this, the provincial level and the federal level, it is corporate politics. Hmm. It is run by the corporate sector. I don't care how you slice it. And if you don't believe me, really, folks, take a look. That's what's going on.
Well, you even have to get larger than that. Go nationally. Let's talk the states. Let's talk the words work, the right to work.
Yeah.
It's not the right to work. It's the right to bankrupt the union so that you don't have any representation. And how that really works, if people aren't aware of it, is you can come into a union setting and they'll ask you if you want to pay union dues. And if you say no, then what they do is they ask you which charity you would like to donate it to, and your union dues go to the charity. But also, if you end up with an issue where you're wrongfully accused of something, or you have something that requires a union to represent you and use its legal means to represent you, the union has to.
Even though they're not a member?
They're a member. They're paying union dues and sending it off to charity. And what's happening is these unions are becoming money poor, and they can't support their members.
And that goes against the RAND agreement, wasn't it?
The RAND formula.
That's it.
With this guy Haddock in Ontario, the last election in Ontario, he wanted to tinker with the RAND formula. In fact, I think he wanted to do away with it. And right away, I said to myself, if the union movement lets that in, they're done. I mean, that's a huge... The RAND formula basically says what you just said. They have to pay union dues even if they're not a member, because they benefit from all the anything that the gains made by the union.
Yeah.
And they benefit from
it's a group of people that we're representing, not a single individual, and that's really what it's all about.
Yeah. I wanted to just finish off this subject. I keep going back to the media because we're part of the media, and we try and do our part to unpack. But one of the things that it was a friend who's a journalist told me about the media, even, this is the powerful, subtle stuff, especially in the print media. You never hear of a union making a request. It's making demands. And the image in your mind demands is the fist on the table, right? The union bosses. All this stuff that makes the unions look like a bunch of the rabble. The employer makes an offer. It's very soft. And what are some of the other ones, union demands? There's other words that are used that definitely skew the whole thing. So the public's image... are these, and because that's all they hear about is the strikes and lockouts or whatever, they think they're just, like a lot of the criticism of the BCTF really surprised me, because I thought, geez, these guys have won not one but two BC Supreme Court decisions. They're just waiting for the government to come through, and the government appeals it. Like, I don't know. Anyway, that deals with anything else you want to say about the media?
I was just thinking, that sounds like that... NLP, if it's repeated, that neuro-linguistic programming,
yeah.
And they say it enough times like that people, you know,
and
they buy it.
Welcome to brainwashing.
It's a type of brainwashing. You know? And, you know, when people talk to me about the bias of the media, yeah, there are biases, but worse than that, it's the fact that I tell people, and Kirk, you can confirm this or not, the basic message coming out of electronic media, radio and television, commercial. The message, the overall message is everything's fine, keep shopping, keep buying, but be fearful because there's something going to, you know, but everything's fine, basically, don't worry about the issues, right? Whereas in this, not only at this radio station, but in community radio station, they're not afraid to discuss the issues, talk about the community, especially the community and all the things going on, people helping people. And so it's a bit of a different message.
Yeah. No, I do agree.
Yeah. And too, CUPE has been at the forefront of trying to deal with the spending money outside a corporate limit, shall we say. CUPE has a program called the 10% Shift, in which our past president, Barry O'Neill, was a huge, huge part of. And, you know, to this day, as far as we're concerned, like, we earn our money locally. We try to spend our money locally, but also, too, you know, everybody has a dollar value out there which they've got to live within, and a lot of the days now where you're feeding families and clothing families, you got to get the best bang for your buck. So, you know, unfortunately, we still have people leaving the community and going to Vernon and to Kamloops and Kelowna to support the economy there. But, you know, more and more people are becoming aware of buying local.
Buying locally and supporting your local. You mentioned off air, you mentioned Askew's and Saskew, but Askew's is one. They support so many different activities in this city. You know, whether it be labor activities, concerts, almost everything you can think of, Askew's is there somewhere supporting it. And they are definitely a very large part of the community. I want to just change gears here just a little bit, if you don't mind. I want to get discuss a little bit, make a comparison between the union movement in its entirety in North America, but let's say just Canada for the moment, and Europe. A lot of the stuff that I've read, and I always, of course, I have a little email at home called The Laughter of the Danes. It was a Canadian who went over to Denmark. But I don't have to talk about that one. I had an experience when I was in the States in 2012, and I came across four Swedes. And they were all four of them were executives of a bus company. So the first thing I asked them about was their taxes. I said, "Are your taxes, how are your taxes? High, low? Oh, they're quite high." And I forget what percentages, they probably varied a little bit, but they were up around 55-60%. Quite high, like huge. A lot higher than ours. And so I said, "Well, does that really tick you off?" "No. Why not?" "Well, because first of all, we're earning a pretty good salary, and we're maybe a little, we're above the average anyway, because we, although we're taxed, we're still, but there's not these huge spreads over there. You know, we're a little bit above the average, but we enjoy a good life, and we're covered. If we go bankrupt, we're covered cradle to grave. Everything. Everything is covered." Well, now that is interesting, and their healthcare system, of course, is very good. So then I jumped to the union movement, and I said, "Okay, what about the unions? Do you have a union in your..." "Oh, yeah, we have a union." "Well, do you like it?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, we have to have the union. They speak for the workers. And if we have any problems with anybody or anything, we go to the union people and talk to them." And he said, "More than that, they have representatives on our board of directors." So they don't have the adversarial system that we have here. They have a, what do you call that, cooperative, collaborative.
Collaborative. You know, and I think when people hear, and I find this with some of our employers, for instance, if you go in and file a grievance, they take it personally.
Yeah.
It's not personal. It's a tool to solve a problem, and it gets us meeting and talking about it. And, you know, quite honestly, probably 90 to 95% of all grievances filed are solved well before arbitration.
Yeah.
So, you know, it creates a form of which we can sit down and discuss the issues. And there's still bosses out there that take them personally, and they're not personal.
No. I wonder if, do you think we're moving more towards a more collaborative system in Canada, or is it?
It's hard to say because, you know, you can take different jurisdictions of CUPE, which I'm familiar with, everything from the paramedics Local 873, which I at one time was actually a provincial executive. I was a regional vice president for the part-timers, and right through to the health sector to, you know, different aspects of where CUPE may be. And each employer has a different take on things. Some are really good to work with, and some are very hard-nosed.
And a lot of it has to do with the government in power, and this particular one's been there for, well, 12 years now, 13 years, actually, 2001. And I got a question for you, reference to paramedics and the ambulance service, because I think it bears repeating. A guy on standby, okay, so he's an ambulance, he's a paramedic, works for the ambulance service. What does he get paid? He's on standby, so if he gets called, he's got to go. What does he get paid?
Not enough.
$2 an hour, I'm told.
Exactly.
$2 an hour to be on standby, which basically says you can't have another job.
No, you can't.
So, you know, I remember when they fought that, I just couldn't believe it. It does relate a little bit to my past air traffic control, because we used to say we're like firemen, or a lot of our work is routine. You're trained, you're highly trained, you know how to do it. But if all hell breaks loose, then you know what to do, and that's what you're trained for. Yeah. And the same with the paramedic. It's for emergencies. It's not just your run of the...
Yeah, and, you know, I had a passion for it. I retired in January, 30 years as a part-time paramedic. Some of the things that just go on with, in particular, the government and the recognition, you know, as you guys were all aware, a few years ago, 873 was on strike. Well,
yeah.
We called it the unstrike because there was nothing we could do, because we couldn't set up picket lines. We couldn't do anything. We just did media blitzes in regards to what we do out there. But, you know, we're the ones out there doing the pre-hospital care. We're the ones out there crawling around the ditches dealing with the people who are in these vehicle accidents and you know, the serious traumas that we have to deal with. And we're also the frontline advocate for the patient out there as well. And there just seems to be absolutely no recognition for the profession. And that's really unfortunate.
It is really unfortunate. You know, we're running out of time, but I want just to hit one more quick subject and ask you a little bit about health and safety in the workplace.
You bet.
And tell me a little bit about what you told me off air about the situation in this province to begin with.
Yeah, you know, last year we had about 100, I do believe the figure was 148 people killed on the job. And the day of mourning, I think I hit a home run with it. And the comment that I made is, you know, that over a three-year period, we lost somewhere around 300 people in the Afghan conflict. And, you know, people were at arms with that. They were upset with people coming home in body bags and things like that. And yet, we do 148 people alone in this province in deaths related to work, and hardly anything's even said about it.
Nothing's said about it, hardly at all. 148 in a year.
You got it.
Well, you know, we could, another subject, maybe we'll come back to it at another in another program, and that is this whole question of the dust in those mills in Burns Lake and the one in, I think it was Prince George, was it? There was another one?
Yes, Burns Lake and Prince George.
Apparently they knew about that and they just never enforced it.
Well, the real atrocity here is nobody's having to stand up and be accounted here.
Accounted for. I'm going to have to say goodbye, Kevin. Kevin Hansen is still here. Kirk had to leave, and I want to thank you for coming, Kevin. Oh, one more thing.
One more thing that I just want to add is I hope everyone listening today has the opportunity to take some time this Labor Day weekend, reflect on how the workers who came before us sacrificed so much to win the rights and benefits we enjoy today. The right to vote, the right of women to vote, the right of First Nations to vote, the right to free speech, the right to bargain collectively. All these things weren't just given to us. The working people banded together and demanded these rights. For me, Labor Day is a time to spend with friends and family, and remember and honor the workers and activists who before gave so much.
Thank you very much, Kevin. And good night. You're listening to CKVS, Voice of the Shuswap.